From the Sky News Centre at 5, a lawyer representing victims of serial sex attacker John Warboys says two of her clients have launched a crowdfunding page as they plan to challenge his release. Earlier, the Justice Secretary decided it wouldn't be appropriate for the government to seek a judicial review after taking legal advice. Warboys could be freed within weeks. Solicitor Kim Harrison.
We feel very, very strongly that their voices need to be heard and that they have the right to know why the parole board came to the decision that they came to, and they also have the right to challenge that decision in the court.
Bankrupt construction giant Carillion's pension deficit could be more than four times bigger than first thought. It's understood to be as high as £2.5 billion. Police are advising people not to travel tonight within much of Scotland's central belt because of forecasts for heavy snow and ice. A Met Office amber warning in place until 10 p.m. is warning that power cuts and travel disruption are possible. Lower level warnings cover Northern Ireland, most of Scotland and parts of Northern England. Forecaster Stephen Keats says if you have to drive, be prepared.
Make sure you've got some food, some hot water, some blankets, potentially things to dig yourself out, a fully charged mobile phone, as hopefully signal will be good enough somewhere to make a call if the worst comes to the worst.
A teenager accused of a bomb attack which injured 30 commuters at Parsons Green tube station in West London has denied responsibility. The 18-year-old Iraqi is accused of building and placing an improvised explosive device on a train in September. Official figures show the high street had its worst December since 2010. Retail sales fell 1.5% last month compared with November. Analysts say promotions like Black Friday mean people are starting their Christmas shopping earlier. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
To have taken all the hassle and stress out of rent collection for landlords with a brand new rent collection service.
Yeah, tune in on Sundays at 7 p.m. right here on BCFM to hear this crazy alien bringing you the latest and greatest in contemporary Christian music. That's me, Danny Lopsch. Join me on Sunday.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Secretary of Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, Matt Carey, and Leader of the Green Group on the City Council, Eleanor Comley. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Gulen movement, what is it? Supposedly behind the coup, attempted coup anyway, in Turkey back in 2016. Former CIA agent Paul Williams spoke to Sean Stone on RT America recently all about Gulen training camps for jihadis inside the United States and how it links through to our very own European Operation Gladio from the 1980s, where NATO's secret military intelligence cells were blowing us up, innocent civilians, all over Europe, and blaming it on the Soviet Union. Plus, is Lebanon hacking our smartphones so they can use them as microphones to spy on us? That's the, on the face of it, ludicrous fake news which has been circulating the globe today. Is it even possible? And an Israeli apprehended over organ harvesting charges. Haven't heard about that on our UK news. Doesn't organ harvesting matter, or is it because he's Israeli and he can't be guilty? And the latest edition of the BBC's House of Saud series on Wednesdays, not Fridays, as I said last week, sorry about that, by former Conspiracy Files producer Mike Rudin. Is this a brave investigative journalism breakthrough out of the BBC mould, or just even more sophisticated propaganda? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius, windy and rainy. This weekend, highs around about 11. A wet weekend, also windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of around 11, plenty of wet and windy weather, but also a few sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 27th and 28th of January, highs of 9 Celsius, sunny spells and a few showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, just to warn you, BCFM manager Pat Hart is moving this show back an hour, so from 2 weeks' time, we'll be starting at 6 and finishing at 8. I realise that makes it impossible to listen to us and then switch over to Points West or ITV West, so much more difficult to follow the local news. But I'm afraid I've not been asked, that's just what I've been told. It also means that this show will be losing many of its drive time listeners. The argument put to me is that if you want music and travel news in the car on the way home, well, there are a few other places you could get that. I may be wrong, but I think there is a place between 5 and 6 as you're driving home after a hard week's work to challenge how Bristol's mayor and the council spends £350 million of our money every year and on Brexit and national policy. Anyway, if like me, you think current affairs should stay on the 5 till 6 drive time slot, please either write to station manager Pat Hart here at Eastern Community Centre, that's Kilburn Street, Bristol BS5 6QW, or you can email him at pat@bcfm.uk and copy me in. My details are at our show page, thisweek.org.uk. As it stands, next week is the last show, which will start at 5 p.m. It's from 6 p.m. from then on. Anyway, hi Matt and Eleanor. That's Matt Carey and Eleanor Cumley. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks for having us on.
First of all, let's just ask a general question. Profit or people first? Is Marvin a mayor or a chief executive? Eleanor.
Well, that's a good question, because we did have a chief executive and it seems that Marvin is taking their place. But I think that there's a lot of focus on money and on how much things cost, and there's not enough focus on the value of things and how much things matter.
But hang on, surely that's absolutely necessary to focus on money. At the moment, we're being told we're going to get less and less of it. So everyone needs to be looking at the money that's coming in, the money that's going out, and trying to make best use of what we've got.
We do need to make best use of what we've got. It's questionable whether that is happening. I was talking to someone the other day who said in the area that they worked in, I'm not going to say which area because I don't want to point the finger at this individual, but they had consultants coming in telling them to do things that basically were already good practice in their area of work and that they knew about, and being paid tens of thousands of pounds for the service. So that's money that could have been spent instead on frontline services. So there are questions about whether the money is going in the right directions.
What about the Rainbow Cabinet? That's all been torn up since I last spoke to you, in fact,
yes.
And thrown away now.
Yes, and that was a great shame. And I do think that it was actually working quite well. Even I know that a lot of people will say there's no way there should have been a Conservative on that Cabinet. But actually, that Conservative member of Cabinet used the fact that she had the ear of the government to go and make the case for Bristol schools, and did get changes to the way that school funding was being allocated that took into account the particular circumstances of Bristol. Now, she and I don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, but I do think in that role, she was working hard for Bristol and she was doing the best that she could in that position.
The reason given was apparently that people have been speaking out of class. Basically, you're supposed to keep what discussion that stays in the cabinet bunker inside the bunker.
No, that wasn't the accusation that was made. Marvin was absolutely clear that he had no criticism. I don't know what he said to the Conservative leader, but to me, he was absolutely clear that he was not criticising Fee Hance in any way, that she'd actually done a brilliant job in the cabinet, that there was never any suggestion that we had leaked anything that came from Cabinet. There was never any suggestion that she hadn't respected the confidentiality of those discussions. What it was that other people in the Green Party, including me, to be fair, had been critical of the mayor. And that's kind of my job.
I think it is. Anyway, Matt Carey from Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance. People or profit first?
Well, we would say definitely people first. And I think that, while Marvin has listened to us to some extent over the cuts and they've rolled back quite a lot of the proposals that were originally put forward. Like, for example, the council tax reduction scheme. They've kicked the library decision down the road a little bit. They've saved some of the lollipop people, etc. We think that he should be putting people first, primarily, and acting more as a political leader rather than an administrator.
Well, one of the things that annoys me is this whole thing about public toilets. That seems to be basic sort of civilised behaviour.
Exactly, yeah, and I think a lot of people are not aware of what's happening. I mean, at the moment we have 36 public toilets, but by the end of the month we'll only have 18. And that's going to be a massive impact on disabled people, people with young kids, etc., who will feel that it's difficult for them to even go out and enjoy the city.
Well, you know what, Eleanor, that bothers me, because you've got some of the most vulnerable people in the city turning up at a public toilet only to find it's closed.
Yes, and it is a cut that we have opposed. I think that what I'm trying to do now is mitigate the impact of that as best we can. So members of the Green Group and councillors from all parties have been going to local businesses in their area and asking people to join a community toilet scheme, so that they will allow us to advertise the fact that they will make their toilets available to members of the public, so that we're not trapping people in their homes. And, you know, in an ideal world, maybe we wouldn't do it that way. Although I do think a lot of businesses are actually quite happy to contribute to their local community. One of my fellow councillors, Carla Denyer, was knocking on doors, and she said she didn't have a single business that said no when she went round and asked them. So I think people are happy to help, but we just have to try and make the best of the situation we've got, because that's a cut that's been agreed by Cabinet. It's been voted through by the Labour Group. It's happening. There's nothing we can do about it.
One of the things that bothers me is that we're supposed to be living in a Labour city, but rather nasty notices are going up about rough sleeping. Rather than housing people, Bristol City Council is putting up notices, this one in Trenchard Street car park, saying public notice, rough sleeping, begging and other antisocial behaviour. Now, excuse me, rough sleeping is not antisocial behaviour. It's something that people need to do, and begging is also something that people need to do. But this is an official Bristol City Council notice here. And obviously, these sorts of things are hidden out of the way where the rough sleepers sleep. Most people won't see these notices. It says, so rough sleeping, begging and other antisocial behaviour, crime and disorder will not be tolerated in this car park. Anyone found engaged in these activities will be banned from the premises. If such bans are ignored, Bristol City Council will seek enforcement by way of court orders, a breach of which could lead to a custodial sentence. Bristol City Council recognises that people find themselves in housing difficulty, would encourage individuals to engage with St Mungo's outreach team, who are commissioned to provide assistance if you're rough sleeping. St Mungo's outreach, they give a phone number there and the address at the Compass Centre, 1 Jamaica Street. Members of the public wishing to report rough sleeping can do so as well, and they give a way that people can do that. Now, this all sounds to me, a bit authoritarian, actually. Where, anyway, Matt, what do you make of notices like this?
Well, I think it's disgraceful, really. I mean, the situation that we're all having to deal with is the massive cuts that have been put through by the Conservative government to welfare and stuff like that. And the reality is there's lots and lots of homeless people. There are people sleeping on the streets, and you're not going to get rid of the problem by being draconian on them. There was this woman the other day, John Langley made a video of her, and she'd been basically just had this notice gaffer taped to her stuff, saying that the Bristol Waste, which is the council waste company, are going to come around and take all her stuff away. And you know, this is people's sleeping bags, stuff that they need to basically stay alive over the sort, you know, at night in the sort of weather that we've.
Yeah, but I suppose what they're saying here is either put your stuff out of the way somewhere, don't bring it into the city centre, and that's reasonable.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it would. There are homeless people all over the city now. I mean, where I live in Bedminster, there are people. You never see homeless people there a few years ago. And then there's constantly people sleeping rough around Bedminster. So people do move out of the city centre. It doesn't make the problem go away.
Anyway, Eleanor, rough sleeping, begging and other antisocial behaviour. What do you make of that?
That's the first I'd heard of that notice. I've made a note to go and investigate that, because that sounds completely out of order and completely out of keeping with what I'm hearing within the council.
But it's okay because members of the public wishing to report rough sleeping can do so.
Yeah, I mean, there is help there if you happen to be someone who has the right to stay here, if you happen to be someone with British nationality, if you happen to be someone with a connection to the city. If you don't fall into all those categories, then you can phone that number all you like. There's not going to be help there for you. I've spoken to a couple of people who said they've come to Bristol because they've got a job here and they've been homeless because they can't find anywhere that they can afford to rent. They can't find anywhere until they've started work. And they've been collecting money to sleep in a hostel for a week or so before they actually start work. And they've been told, I was talking to a man, he had found a job. He needed to take the tent with him to go and take up that job, which is incredible. You know, someone sleeping on the streets has managed to organise themselves to find a job. It's an incredible achievement, but that would leave his partner homeless, and the council were not helping them because they didn't have a connection to the city, because they'd been living abroad and they'd only recently moved back. So there's all kinds of ways that you can fail to get that help.
Well, it's all very well going on about the St Mungo's outreach team, but speaking to homeless people, as I've done, a lot of them say, well, too many drugs at St Mungo's. We don't want to be near hard drugs. We need to be away from hard drugs and violence sometimes. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, that this is part of the programme at St Mungo's. Of course it's not. But for many people, it simply doesn't work, Eleanor.
Yes, I was talking to another young man, a really vulnerable young man who had quite strong mental health needs. And he just couldn't be in a hostel. It was too upsetting for him. Even without things breaking out into violence, just the sort of aggression, the loudness of other people in those hostels was just terrifying for him. And he'd ended up sleeping in a shed, sleeping on a building site. He'd been finding places to sleep, none of which was doing any good for the state of his mental health. And there was just a real need for services to wrap around him and stop things getting worse. I mean, I'm really pleased to hear that one of the things that is being looked at in Bristol is this idea of housing first, where rather than waiting until someone has been through the various stages of kind of emergency housing, moving on to different levels of support, and then finally, when they don't need any support and they're able to live independently, then you put them into housing. The idea that you just say, OK, well, let's just solve the problem of housing first. Let's get them somewhere that is their own, where they can stay and be safe. And then you give them all the other support, the mental health support, and really dealing with the trauma that they've been through in the years of being homeless. You do that afterwards, but that you first sort out just a safe place of their own.
But it's okay, because we're going to have an underground. Actually, no, an arena. Although, you see, this is what I'm talking about here is Carillion, because some of these massive contracts that the government are starting to look at, I mean, we've had the big spiralling in costs of Metrobus, which still hasn't opened. And so I wonder, maybe you could just help us out here, Matt. I mean, we're talking about central government now. It doesn't seem to have a handle or any proper financial controls on our money. I mean, we're paying our taxes, whether it's VAT, whether it's, you know, there's thousands of different types of ways we pay tax without hardly even realising it, income tax, etc. And when they spend our money, it seems quite clear from the collapse of Carillion this week that there is no actual financial control at all. No one is doing the checks, and if there's someone auditing the company, then they're signing it off as absolutely fine when it's about to fall to pieces.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole PFI thing and the privatisation agenda that's been going on for over 30 years now in this country is, in my view, is just legalised corruption, because instead of politicians taking responsibility for what they do with our money, they hand it over to these private companies. A lot of them are giving donations to the political parties involved, and it's... there is no accountability, as you say, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. Now we're realising that the National Audit Office yesterday said that we're on the hook for £200 billion to these people, and they're just spivs, really, that are just ripping us off.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what's your take on the collapse of Carillion? Because, I mean, I've mentioned a couple of these big local government contracts which will be being signed with local developers, the underground and the arena, that sort of thing. But we're also talking about much, much bigger national government contracts, such as HS2, which Carillion was supposed to be involved in. Obviously, there won't be any more. And Hinkley C, for example.
Well, I think subcontracting construction projects to the private sector has a certain rationale, unless you're going to have a massive in-house government-run construction agency, as it were. But I think what's really telling is that all of the things like school meals and local authority functions, which have been privatised, they are all now in commercial meltdown, because it's all linked to Carillion. So, and of course the idea that there's any competition in this, that there's only a few big suppliers that bid for these huge contracts, and then of course they go bust, and because they've got all their fingers in all these different pies, that creates huge problems for local authorities across the country, where these things should have been done in-house. And as Matt's pointed out, this is the fruit of 30 years of idiotic policy, and we had 13 years of Labour governments, and they carried on with this. They didn't, that should have been knocked on the head as soon as Tony Blair came to power.
Some of these contracts have actually been done by companies that have done what they said they would do. Carillion quite clearly wasn't doing, because, we had KPMG sign off their accounts last year as give them a clean bill of health, and yet there were profit warnings, and the government doesn't know. Notice that this is going on, and in the meantime, of course, between the KPMG accounts being signed off by KPMG and these profit warnings, the insiders in the business, I'm talking about the senior management and the directors possibly, have been taking everything they possibly can out of that business, and finally we're left to pick up the bill.
Indeed, and of course the suggestion is that the government knew that they were in trouble and then carried on handing out contracts to them in order to try and prevent them from going into receivership.
There was a boost in the share price last week, so someone is obviously trying to make it look as if this company is viable. There's insider dealing, this sort of thing been going on. Is there going to be any proper investigation?
The big care home people are about to go bust as well. That's another big issue. These things used to be done by local authorities. Care homes used to be provided by local authorities, and they've been turned into private sector subcontractors, and then they go bust, and then of course the state has to step in, just as the banking system. You can't let all this stuff go down, and think of the amount of money that's going to be wasted here, and then they're trying to scratch money back by bullying homeless people. It's beyond belief, really, isn't it?
Matt, what have you found out about the collapse of Carillion? Because I know you've been looking into it. It'd be just quite interesting to know some of the individuals like I mentioned KPMG there, who are very, very much involved here in Bristol City Council with the arena project, in the mayor's office, etc., saying, oh yeah, this is fine, this company, yeah, giving it a clean bill of health, signing off the audit, and then all of a sudden we find that was a load of rubbish.
Yeah, well, I think the whole thing was this sort of web of subcontractors, and they're skimming bits of money off of everyone, and it's all, at the end, it's quite clear that they were only being sustained by new government contracts being awarded to them. If it hadn't been for them getting their part of the HS2 consortium, they would probably have gone bust 6 months ago. So,
I noticed that they were involved up at Southmead, in the Southmead Hospital. And was told at the time, although he couldn't corroborate it, by one of the people who was working on the, at least to do with the building of Southmead Hospital, that they were taking something like 5-6% cut. So Carillion weren't actually doing anything. Yeah. They were just dishing out construction contracts to their friends and saying, well, we will take X from the government, we'll take 15, whatever, between 5 and 15% off of that, and then we'll give you the money.
Yeah.
So all they were was effectively they've managed to get the contract,
yeah,
and they were just skimming off a bit of profit for themselves without actually doing anything.
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago, they built the Great Western Hospital in Swindon as well, which is another big hospital, and they were... It was a PFI deal. They were running the... They employed the porters and the cleaners and stuff directly. And there was a big strike because most of the porters were Goans. There was a big Goan community in the middle of Swindon. And they were... the managers were demanding presents from them, basically, like duty-free cigarettes and stuff like that, to let them have their annual leave in blocks to go to go back home to visit their families. You know, that it was that sort of basic corruption was going on, and the GMB went on strike to deal with them, you know. And I think there was a teacher on the school, a teacher in a school on the TV the other day whose school had been built by Carillion, and he said that he had a huge list of jobs that needed to be done that they just hadn't done, and they're getting charged. Schools are getting charged sort of £9,000 to replace a blind or something like that.
I reckon is Carillion are looking at it and thinking, can we get away with just ignoring that?
Yeah,
let's just ignore it.
Exactly. Well, I agree with what Jeremy Corbyn said at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. He said that a lot of these companies need to be shown the door. These jobs need to be done by public sector workers with a public sector ethos.
Okay, well, I'll let you introduce Prime Minister's Questions then for Wednesday, where Jeremy Corbyn took Theresa May on over this collapse.
It's a bit late for one subcontractor. Floratech, owed £800,000 by Carillion, have already had to make some of their staff redundant because of the collapse. But, Mr. Speaker, this isn't one isolated case of government negligence and corporate failure. It's a broken system. Under this government, Virgin and Stagecoach can spectacularly mismanage the East Coast Main Line and be let off a £2 billion payment. Capita and Atos can continue to wreck the lives through damaging disability assessments of many people with disabilities and win more government-funded contracts. G4S promised to provide security at the Olympics, failed to do so, and the army had to step in and save the day. These corporations, Mr. Speaker, need to be shown the door. We need our public services provided by public employees with a public service ethos and a strong public oversight. As the ruins of Carillion lie around her, will the Prime Minister act to end this costly racket of the relationship between government and some of these companies?
I might first of all remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that a third of the Carillion contracts with the government were let by the Labour government. What we want is to provide good quality public services delivered at best value to the taxpayer. We're making sure in this case that public services continue to be provided, that the workers in those public services are supported and taxpayers are protected. But what Labour oppose isn't just a role for private companies in public services, but the private sector as a whole. The vast majority of people in this country in employment are employed by the private sector. But the Shadow Chancellor calls businesses the real enemy. Labour want the highest taxes in our peacetime history. Labour policies would cause a run on the pound. This is a Labour Party that has turned its back on investment, on growth, on jobs. A Labour Party that will always put politics before people.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of boilerplate there from Theresa May. I mean, when she says that more people are employed in the private sector, that's because the people that used to be employed in the public sector are now employed in the private sector. Like people who provide school dinners, for example, used to be public employees and now they're private employees.
Like Capita and Carillion.
Yes, indeed. And so, in other words, they're not really employed by the private sector. The ultimate source of the funding for this comes from the government. But, of course, once it's subcontracted out, it then becomes magically the private sector, even though, in actual fact, it isn't the private sector, and the demand is coming from the government. Modern economies have a very substantial public sector. That's what with modern economies since the 1940s.
But they're running it down here, aren't they?
Well, what they're doing is they're making an imaginary private sector, but there's a whole new private sector that's been created by subcontracting in the public sector. But it's not really private. It's actually public money that we're talking about here. It's just being shockingly misspent.
So why are we getting no warnings about the collapse of Carillion from Labour then?
Well, how are Labour supposed, or anybody in the...
Profit warnings in the papers?
Well, yes, of course, and some people have been following this closely. I mean, the problem is, and Theresa May did put her finger on it, which is that the Labour Party, when it was in power, and I'm a member of the Labour Party, there was 13 years when they were in power, and they carried on the PFI nonsense.
So
and
is Corbyn really going to be any different? I mean, he talks the talk.
Well, this is the whole point. This is why there has been a rebellion in the Labour Party. It's because the grassroots of the party have always been hostile to this, and they've been ignored and overruled. Now, you could argue when Blair was first elected, right, you've got to have one term in Parliament where you don't actually go for the jugular. But at three terms, in 13 years, you should have knocked this stuff on the head. And the reason they didn't is because they wanted to spend money on various things which were worth spending money on, you know, rebuilding schools and so on. But they didn't want to put it they didn't want the government to do it because the PFI allows it on an accounting basis to be counted as if it's not government expenditure. So it's fundamentally fraudulent. And it's all to do with keeping the supposed level of public expenditure down. And I would argue that Britain is a northern European country like Denmark or Norway, and we should have a substantial functioning public sector, and ultimately after the crash, which I always talk about, we will rebuild and the economy will be substantially
Martin,
a public sector economy with a residual
Martin,
private sector.
There won't be a crash. All the time the super rich are creaming it off everyone else.
Well, there? I mean, we were talking earlier about money and how it's been spent. The stock markets around the world are at their highest levels ever at the end of last year, and as Donald Trump said, this is a bubble. Before he was elected, he's now going about how marvellous it all is. And of course, what's actually happening there? People say, "Well, where's the money for our schools, hospitals, helping the homeless?" The money has all been pushed into the hands of the stock market and the financial services industry, and it's totally fraudulent. It's all based on stock buybacks, and it's definitely going to burst.
Anyway, sticking with Carillion,
the Carillion could bring down the whole economy. Just think about this. If this is a $200 billion hole. That's a substantial, and the knock-on effects of that, this could be the beginning. And she was talking there about a run on the pound. There's already been a run on the pound because of Brexit. Mm. And there's every possibility there's going to be somebody like George Soros is going to take a position on the pound at some point soon.
So is it just a question of someone somewhere in the world like Soros just saying, well, I'm going to bet on this, and that's it?
That's what happened when we forced out of the ERM. Soros, because he's so big, he put a big short on the pound. Everybody else follows him. And then, of course, they had to raise interest rates to 15% in one day, and then they had to collapse, and then that's what will happen.
Didn't they do something similar at the Battle of Waterloo where Nathaniel Rothschild made all his money originally?
Well, that's right, because he had more, he got information about the result of the battle before everybody else, so he'd already taken his position.
And as he started to sell, everyone in the saw him selling and thought, oh, we must have lost.
Yeah, well, that's right. These things are capable of being manipulated. And of course, the problem is that if there is a run on the pound, Philip Hammond will have to raise interest rates to protect the currency, and at that point the housing market collapses.
Anyway, Mark,
and we have the Brexit recession
back
that people have been saying is going to happen.
One thing that's bothered me, and this is on Tom Pride's blog, I haven't seen anything about this in the local press. Disgraced Carillion chief is now the director of the firm in charge of inspections at Hinkley Point C nuclear power station. In June last year, the man responsible for the debacle, incompetent former group chief executive of Carillion, Richard Howson, stood down, seemingly disappeared the same day the company's disastrous finances were revealed. Only after paying himself £1.5 million and tens of thousands in bonuses and perks, leaving the firm with a massive £800 million pension deficit and debts with £1.4 billion. But he is in charge of inspections at the new Hinkley C.
Well, it's a revolving door, isn't it? These things have been going on for years, and this may actually undermine the government completely if people see the consequences of this playing out. they ought to draw the relevant conclusions about who should be in charge and who shouldn't.
Matthew Carey from Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Ben Chu has written in quite a good piece. We'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk in The Independent. Carillion collapse. Five urgent questions the government must answer. Maybe you can help the government. Why were public contracts awarded after it was known the company was in trouble? Why was the government so reliant on one single company? Why was the Carillion chair advising the government on corporate social responsibility? Why hasn't the whole thing been nationalised? And shouldn't this prompt a wider rethink of privatisation?
Well, the question of nationalisation is a good point, because what are they going to do? They're going to suddenly re-tender all these hundreds and hundreds of contracts? I think they're going to have to at least temporarily nationalise a lot of it.
I think some of the contracts automatically sort of kick over to another one. Almost they knew that this was coming.
Yeah. I mean, but then, how stable are these other companies like Carillion? I mean, there was in the news yesterday, Interserve, which is a very similar company, actually bigger than Carillion. Again, a building company with outsourcing, a big outsourcing section as well. And they seem to be on the brink of collapse as well. So it might be a whole domino effect going on there.
Well, there's an article on the BBC. The BBC, it's almost like the government press agency these days, isn't it? They say the government is reassuring us over Interserve. So there's no question there. Even though if you go into the article, you'll see their share prices falling, Eleanor.
Yes, I'm sure the government are reassuring us as fast as they can, but I don't think that necessarily means it's a judgment that we can rely on. They've shown how badly flawed their judgment is. I think when we see companies like Virgin, like Carillion, like Interserve getting given these huge government contracts and then coming back and requiring a bailout, as we've seen for Virgin, and now Carillion have collapsed and kind of left us holding the baby, we've got to ask what they're playing at, really. I think one of the key things is, who is too big to fail? You know, the banks were too big to fail. The East Coast Mainline is too big to fail. Carillion is too big to fail. Well, and all of these
KPMG
things get...
KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young and Deloitte all seem too big to fail.
And government will step in and support them.
And but too big to jail.
We were talking earlier about the numbers of homeless on British streets. And is that not too big to fail? Are human lives not too big to fail? Why are we not stepping in and doing something about these emergencies? A bank collapsing... Some people will lose some money, but why did we pay the banks? Why didn't we just let them collapse and compensate the individuals who were badly affected? We could have saved a fortune.
You know what Jeremy Corbyn called it just then? He called it a racket. So maybe there's a clue in that. Anyway, look, let's just focus again on some of this local stuff, because the Bristol's litter police, we were chatting about last week as well, have tried to fine a non-smoker for dropping a cigarette butt on Gloucester Road. The woman denied the offence and refused to pay the fine. A non-smoker was forced to protest her innocence after being accused of dropping a cigarette butt by the Bristol litter police. The woman, who wished to remain anonymous, was asked to provide the enforcement officer with her details after allegedly dropping a cigarette butt on Gloucester Road. But the 40-year-old woman from Bishopston argued it could not have been her who dropped the butt. She doesn't smoke. She refused to provide the officer with her name and left without paying the fine, despite being threatened with the police being called. The annoying thing was, he accused me of dropping a fag butt. She said, I just come out of the gym and had no cigarettes or lighter even on me. Eleanor, who are these litter police? They sound like a sort of like little mini Gestapo running around town.
So this is a company called Kingdom, and they are coming in. They're being paid to enforce the rules that we already have around dropping of litter, dog fouling. And a lot of people would like to see those rules followed, if not enforced, because it is unpleasant. You know, these are the streets where we live. These are the places we take our kids to school or our parents to the hospital, or these are our shared public spaces.
Well, I suppose that woman would say, or the litter police would say, that woman could be lying.
Yeah, I mean, I think human being makes mistake. is not news. An individual enforcement officer getting it wrong is not a big deal. I think we have to see if there's a pattern of this.
But there is a bit of a pattern, because another story,
that is
another
we
story
need to look
this
at.
Week, another story this week in the Post. Bristol City Council have been accused of turning the litter police against its own staff. Staff accused the litter police of hiding behind walls, trying to catch them out. The council staff claim they're being deliberately targeted by the authority's own litter police. Employees at a 100 Temple Street council building say the litter enforcement officers hide round corners to try and target smokers who might drop cigarette butts. Launched in November, the litter police can issue fines of up to £75 to people caught dropping rubbish, spitting or carrying out vandalism. The Bristol Post understands Kingdom, the company contracted to carry out the enforcement, has issued council staff with a number of fines in the past week. The Bristol City Council said its staff need to be leading by example and not immune to the fines. However, the irony has not escaped one employee who says the council is essentially paying people to police its own staff.
I saw one of these guys today when we were giving out leaflets for our public meeting next week, and it is a bit kind of draconian, like we were saying about the homeless people. But another thing I noticed in the some of the details about the 2018-19 budget that came out in the Post this week is that one of the money-making measures that they're going to bring in is trying to get an extra £100,000 a year in fines out of people. I'm not sure whether that's specifically to do with traffic fines or parking fines, but fines anyway. So we're paying for the cuts always.
There's something very different between these guys and the police, isn't there? Because they're quite clearly on some sort of a bonus of some sort. So they're being encouraged financially to do this. Now, yeah. I don't know if the police were to be paid on sort of piecework, as if, you know, the amount of money they can fine people that they will get then in their salary or something, that would be a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, you end up in a situation like in Russia or somewhere where, you know, you just give them a backhander and they let you off because it's like more than their kickback on the fine. You know, it's a dangerous path to go down, I think.
Also having disputes with we were talking about Cabot Circus, private security getting rid of the litter police off their land because they didn't want them there. Now apparently they're back again, but now we have problems at Temple Quay. Bristol litter police say they can issue fines on any land open to the air. Office workers in Temple Quay said the enforcement officers do not have the required permission before issuing fines there because it's their property, their land. So a bit bizarre, isn't it? So if it's your private land, these litter police might wander on, Eleanor, and tell you you can't drop that there.
Yes, I have heard that there.
And you're fined £75.
That is supposedly public space. Anything which is sort of advertises itself as public space and has no signs saying don't come in, they say they can fine that. I need to go and read the detail of the legislation on that.
Anyway, we may have even more on the litter police next week. We'll see. I've got a hint that we might, actually. So anyway, stand by on that one. Our last show before we get kicked back to 6 p.m. We have some more on the litter police, hopefully. But let's have a look at the health service now. And this was from last night's BBC Question Time, where Andy Burnham was discussing, he's the Labour Party mayor of Manchester these days, discussing with, I'm not exactly sure what her ministerial role is, I'd never heard of her, Margot James, apparently is a culture minister of some sort, but anyway, she made the attempt to reply, and and it was up in Hereford. I noticed on Twitter afterwards as well, a lot of people saying, Hereford, well done, let's go to Hereford for a holiday, that sort of thing, after what was quite a feisty end to BBC Question Time last night.
I want to look at nurse development and training in the context of Brexit and the challenges it might pose. I want to grow more of our own young people to become NHS staff. I'm looking at an idea that if young people commit to the Greater Manchester NHS for 5 years after qualifying, that we might help pay off some of their tuition fees in response to have a better approach to helping young people come through. But actually, Munira's right. There's a deeper reason here. Why is there so much pressure on nurses? Go back to another layer of the care workforce, social care staff. They are in an even worse position. They do 15-minute slots. They don't get the travel time between the 15 minutes, so they don't even get paid the national minimum wage. Social care in this country is utterly broken. Okay. I tried to fix it as Health Secretary. Since then, there's just been point scoring about it. In my view, and this again is what we're trying to do in Greater Manchester, it is time for social care fully to come within the public National Health Service. One service. In this 70th anniversary year, that is the way to renew the National Health Service for the century of the ageing society. One service covering people's physical, mental and social needs. And if you want one example where outsourcing really has seen the worst kind of capitalism, it is in social care, where older people have seen services utterly slashed and there's been profiteering on the backs of the most vulnerable people in our society.
Quick if you would, because we're coming towards the end.
What I don't understand is there is so much public support to put more money into our NHS, to pay our nurses more, to support our nurses and reinstall the bursary programme. Because if you're going to be a nurse and you're going to qualify earning less than £30,000 a year, but you ended up in so much debt with such high interest rates to pay, why would you do it? It doesn't make any sense. And I wonder if, you know, the Conservative government that we have is ideologically making the NHS, underfunding it, so then they can make the argument for privatisation.
You'll have to be very brief in your
well,
answer.
I'm very sorry there's such enthusiasm for what you've said, because it is utterly untrue. I've been accused of wanting to set the NHS up to fail so that we can privatise it. Nothing could be further from the truth. No, I am not a liar. I have spent time volunteering in the NHS over 4 or 5 years. I am not a liar. I believe in the NHS, and so does my government. And so does my government. And we do put more money into it. We put an extra three. I'm going to carry on answering this question.
Let her finish. We are ending the programme. Just the last sentence.
We have put an extra £3.5 billion in at the last budget. We've increased the NHS budget every year since we got into office. I do accept there's more demographic pressures on it. I do accept that. That is true. But it is not true to say that we do not invest in the NHS. And it is an utter lie to say that we don't believe in it, because we do.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's interesting that she should say that, because Jeremy Hunt, who is the health secretary, wrote a pamphlet, came out a couple of years ago, where
it was called Direct Democracy, an Agenda for a New Model Party. And I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Well, in that, he basically argues that we should move towards an insurance-based system. And there it is. It's not something from his callow youth.
A quote.
This was 2 years ago.
A quote from it. He actually says we've got to denationalise it.
We've got to denationalise it. And of course, he was going to be sacked by Theresa May. And he famously walked into the meeting with her and then walks out. And of course, what she did is she gave him social care, which is what Andy Burnham was talking about there, that social care should be an NHS responsibility. And I tend to agree with that. But of course, the fact is that in Bristol, for example, we used to have home helps who were directly employed by the council. They were unionised. They were paid something like £9 or £10 an hour. They had a job for life, as it were, and they were very dedicated people. And they were all got rid of, and it's all been subcontracted out to people on much less money, and with zero hours contracts, etc. And of course, this is at the same time as we were bailing out the banks and so on. So the Tory party have now got themselves in a position where they're handing out, tax cuts to their friends at the same time as pretending there's no money. And the fact is that their priorities are just wrong.
Now, Eleanor, you're leader of the Green Group here on Bristol City Council. What do you make of this?
Well, we often talk about, are they planning to privatise the NHS? They're not planning to do it. They are already doing it. There are millions and millions of pounds worth of private contracts going out of the NHS. In fact, there are millions of pounds each year spent just on running the artificial market system that allows those contracts to go out to private companies. So, don't imagine that they might think about privatising it somewhere down the line. Just because something has the NHS logo on it, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not being offered by a private company right now.
I was looking at the panel last night on the BBC Question Time. Not at all balanced. There's three Tories, basically. Well, I say Tories. One of them was a former boss of RBS, who, of course, got away with the biggest crime of the century in 2008, so far, that is, stealing all of our money and getting bailouts from the government. And then there was the woman from London was actually Boris Johnson's number two deputy mayor. A very, very unbalanced panel, and yet these people are presented as independent somehow. I find it absolutely wonderful when someone from the audience, Matt, actually comes up with the point that nobody on the panel seems to have noticed.
Well, yeah, that's right. Those are the best moments in Question Time when you get someone from the audience who's actually real.
How propaganda works, isn't it? You know, you have a spread of opinion on a panel, as we've got here, you know, and there's certain points of view just simply not represented. Now, you three are all very left-wing, right? So I've got to try and be the Tory, if at all possible. But, you know, I suppose putting the point really for Margot James there is almost impossible, because it's quite clear that there is a process of privatisation going on.
Yeah.
And so when she says I'm a liar, well, she obviously hasn't read Jeremy Hunt's pamphlet. Anyway, let's move on. Have a look at our next story is one that was on the radio, but the radio really rather cheeky on Five Live on Wednesday, the Emma Barnett show. They faded it down at Prime Minister's Questions, pretending that was the end of it, but it wasn't. There were actually several more questions, and one of them was very interesting. It's about what's going to happen over in Wales after Brexit and all the preparations or otherwise that are being made for that.
Liz Savile-Roberts.
Diolch yn fawr, the people of Wales have been taking back control since 1999, but the EU withdrawal bill will put our powers back under lock and key in Westminster. Yeah. My colleague Stefan Lewis AM is today proposing a Welsh continuity bill to ensure our powers are at liberty. When this Plaid Cymru bill wins a majority in our Assembly, will the Prime Minister support it and respect Wales's sovereignty?
Yeah. I say to the Honourable Lady that her portrayal of what is happening in the EU withdrawal bill is simply wrong. We are working with the devolved administrations to ensure that we deal with the issues that have been raised around Clause 11 and the question of powers that need to remain at UK level to ensure our internal market, but extra powers will be devolved to the devolved administrations. We continue to work with the devolved administrations on this, and we will be bringing forward amendment to Clause 11 in the House of Lords, but we want to ensure that that meets the needs of the UK and of the devolved administrations.
Thank you.
I think that's just a case in point. When the government talk about Brexit being about taking back control, it's very clear that it's them taking back control from the people, from the regions, from anyone who's managed to get their hands on a little bit of power, except for them and their corporate friends.
They can have a bit of a fight with the Scots, aren't they?
They will indeed. And though I think that we really will look at the breakup of the United Kingdom if they are too forceful in that fight.
Apparently there's a bit of a slush fund up in Scotland for a new Hadrian's Wall, so maybe they're... I don't know if that... Martin, what do you make of this? Because this is an old system, really, which was brought in by Blair, actually, in the 1990s, this devolution of power, but it looks like Brexit is being... it's going to be scrapped.
Well, the thing is that there are questions here about mandates and what mandates people have actually got. And, for example, if you actually toss up the votes at the last election, the Tories wouldn't have won under a PR setup. And I think that this is beginning to... And, of course, the Irish government or the French government or the German government who they're negotiating with, because they do have a different electoral system, they've got a mandate. The problem with the Tories is they're just used to running the country because they think it belongs to them. And
doesn't it?
That is the attitude.
The ownership.
But in actual fact, the questions of mandates really start to come up. The six counties of Northern Ireland voted to remain inside the EU. And that included, substantial loyalist voters voting to stay in the EU. Now, I'm not saying that that's a mandate, but the idea that can be... The DUP haven't got a mandate to take the six counties out of the European Union. And these questions about mandates are really important. And sovereignty.
I think
people keep bandying the word sovereignty around. Sovereignty is what the war in Ireland was all about. And the Tories start brandishing this word sovereignty they need to think about very carefully about what they're talking about.
One thing for certain about Brexit is it's going to really concentrate everyone's mind on general elections. It's going to make a real difference who manages to come to power, Matt.
Yeah, well, I can't see Theresa May surviving this year, to be honest, because these contradictions between Ireland, I mean, they fudged it in the preliminary deal that they struck just before Christmas. You know, basically she tried to blag it, and then Arlene Foster stood up and said, I'm not putting up with this, and she had to abandon her trip to Brussels.
A quick couple more little clips from Prime Minister's questions. First, on plastic waste. This is, I suppose, for you, Eleanor, but I mean, everyone obviously is interested in these green issues.
To Desmond Swain.
Yeah! He was a sleeping MP, by the way. He's in the news for being asleep in the chamber. That's why they're cheering.
Order! Order! The Right Honourable Gentleman is extremely alert! And I want order! And I'm alert to what he's going to say! Sir Desmond!
A question keeps me awake at night. How will companies be encouraged to follow her lead in the way that Iceland has done?
No, I'm very pleased to say that we've seen Iceland this week making a commitment to be plastic free. We've seen other companies actually making commitments to ensure that any plastics they use are recyclable in a number of years. And I'm very happy to join my honourable friend in saying we will be encouraging companies to follow Iceland's lead. We'll also be consulting on how the tax system or the introduction of charges could further reduce the amount of waste we create. And we're launching a new plastics innovation fund backed up by additional funding that the government's investing in research and development to ensure that we do really reduce the amount of plastic that is used and leave this planet, this land, in an environment in a better state than we found it.
There was a lovely phrase from Molly Scott-Cato, our MEP, that the action from the Tory government was just a drop in a plastic-filled ocean. And I think that when I hear Tories talking about how great they are and for the environment, I think they are fundamentally rooted in a system which harms our environment, which diminishes the quality of human life. And everything else they do is window dressing, to be perfectly honest.
I was interested because this was some guy popped up at the Bilderberg conference, which I follow very closely, up in the United States last year. So all of the super rich elite arms dealers and everything. And then suddenly some guy to do with the plastic campaign last year. I was thinking, what's this all about? It's very strange. But 6 months later, it just seems to be everywhere. You've got to do something. We've got to do something about the plastic. Martin, is this some sort of PR? Is there anything to this?
Well, it is. It's window dressing, isn't it? It's greenwash, pretending to care about the environment. Meanwhile, the system that they represent continues to grind on with all of its consequences.
We saw something similar to that, actually, with the biotapestry. We were told the biotapestry is coming. But apparently it's going to take 5 years before it comes. And anyway, there is a biotapestry over in Reading that you can go and see, which is a much better copy because it was made in Victorian times.
I fail to see what this has got to do with plastic.
Well, what I'm saying is spin. We've been told this in the news. Right. It's a bit like the Underground, isn't it? It's a big announcement, but, you know, is it ever really going to mean anything? There isn't any real interrogation by our news media, it doesn't seem, of whether these things are real or not. Anyway, that's all we've got time for because it's time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock now. Thanks to our guests, Secretary of Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, Matt Carey, and leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Eleanor Cumley.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.